chapter, it says he hit the water in verse 14. So what does it say? I mean, Hebrew says hafu. What?
And said.
No.
It was the Lord God of Eliyahu.
Right.
And he also had struck the water.
Oh, and he also?
When he had also.
Okay, that's a strange translation of afu. I'm not sure what to do with that afu. What's that? Afu is even him.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I know who it is. It means like Eliyahu had struck the waters before him. I apologize. Right, that's what it means. Okay. Vayakeh tamayim. You're okay? Have a place? Vayakeh, is this something good? Yeah, it means just like Eliyahu. I didn't understand that at first. Yeah. Hina vayakeh tamayim vayechatsu hina vahina ve'abor eliyash. Elisha. So essentially he goes in reverse and comes back to Israel by splitting the Jordan River. Vayiruhu. Now here we get the interesting part. Here's where it all comes together. Now what I want to do is I'm just going to read quickly from verse 15 to verse 25, show you how much weird. I'm just going to read through it quickly and translate it quickly without commenting on it, if I can help myself, which I usually can. And then I'll show you how different it is when we take it slowly and do a close read. When you do a fast read, it's one of those things that will bother Rabbi Spivak for 30 years, and not only Rabbi Spivak, a lot of other people. But I'll compare that to a slow read where we take it step by step, and I'll show you that the story comes out completely different when you pay attention to the details. Vayiruhu v'nei ha-nevi'im asher b'yicho. So the prophets that were in, I would mistranslate it as the sons of the prophets. That's not what B'nai Yisrael means. B'nai Yisrael means the people of Israel. So B'nai Nevi'im are not the children of the prophets. They're simply the prophets. Asher b'yicho mineged, that are against Yericho, because Yericho is right across from the Jordan River. Vayomru nacha ruach Eliyahu Elisha. Cool. But they said the spirit of Eliyahu has fallen on Elisha. Because they know that because they saw the Jordan split. So it doesn't take too much brain work to put that together. So they come to him and they bend down, they bow down on the ground. And they say to him, Hinei na yeshet avadecha, chamishim anashim bnei chayil, yelchu na vivakshu et adonecha, pen yinasu ruach Hashem v'yashlicheu b'achar arim, o b'achat hageaot, v'yomer lo tishlachu. So just to read it through quickly, they said, listen, we're going to take 50 men, okay, and they bowed down to him. Let's take 50 men, we're going to send them to check out for Eliyahu, because it's possible that Eliyahu is on one of his little windy trips, right? Don't forget that when Eliyahu came back from being with the woman who lost her son and then had the son revived, the servant of Ahab comes out, his name was Ovadiahu, and he says, who knows, I'm going to go and tell Ahab that you're here, and then God's wind will take you off to one of those places nobody knows where you are. So this is a very, obviously, kind of like Eliyahu had the reputation of just, you know, coming and going like the wind, so to say.
So they're thinking that he might
be thinking maybe
be
he's
around.
Still around, yeah. Now the question is that why, it's not clear why they say B'nai Chayil. What do they need B'nai Chayil for? I don't need a soldier to check out. I'm sort of mistranslating on purpose, but they want these 50 B'nai Chayil to go check it out, and Elisha says don't send them. I'm gonna
say that maybe God sent.
They sent him on a mission, we'll go look for him and we'll find him. Yeah, he hasn't disappeared. He's just on one of his long trips. Who knows? He's on one of those mountains. God told him to walk up to a mountain and spend another 40 days on the top of the mountain. Could happen. But Elisha says, Lo tishlachu, don't send them. And now, Vayipsuru vo'ad bosh. So they kept on bugging him and bugging him. The last time, one of the famous places where it says Vayipsuru was with Shimshon's wife. What was her name? Delilah. Yiftzerubo. So she kept bugging him until he wanted to tear his hair out, literally. So Vayomer Shalachu. So he finally says, all right, send. Vayishlachu chamishim ish vayivakshu shloshi amim below matzav. So they looked for him 3 days, they couldn't find him. Remember I explained to you last time, but I'll repeat it here again, that Eliyahu essentially did a reverse Yoshua coming in. Yoshua first crossed the river, then to Jericho, then to Beit El. So he goes from Beit El to Jericho and over the river. And this idea of looking for him for 3 days should remind you of when the two spies came to Rahab, the prostitute, or the innkeeper, whatever she was, probably a prostitute, and she told them to go look for them, and they sent them in the wrong direction. They looked for 3 days and they couldn't find them. So of course 3 days may just be one of those things, but I think that there's a certain there's just too many things in common. The prophet's trying to what either Elisha himself or what Yirmiyahu was trying to do is just trying to say this is one of those seminal moments. This is like a Joshua coming in. That's how important this is. If there are more connections, there may be, but I don't see them. But there's really literary connections. Now they come back to him and he's sitting in Yericho. I'm going to mistranslate that word Yoshev, because that's really not what Yoshev means. I'm going to continue on. Vayomer lehem, halo amarti alechem, al tilechu. Didn't I tell you not to go? It's very funny. It's like one of those things, this weird conversation to get here. I told you not to go. It sounds almost petty, to be perfectly honest. Vayomeru an shei ha'ir elisha, hinei na moshav ha'ir tov. Listen, the settlement of the city, that is where the city is situated, is very good. Kasher aduni roeh, like you see. Vahamayim ra'im, but, in that case the vav is a but the water stinks. Va'aretz mishakelet, and the land, l'shakel means to destroy, to cause death. The place where that word mishakel, well, first of all you have the word l'shakelet yadav, when he crossed his hands, but you also have the word l'shakel when Hagag, the king of Amalek, comes back and he's spared by Shaul, and then Shmuel comes along and he says, ah, you're the Malach HaMavet because you, Shmuel, are going to kill me. And Shmuel is not impressed, and he says, just like wives, just like mothers have been mishakel of their sons by your sword, so too will your mother be mishakel on my sword. So Shmuel is not too impressed with Hagag accusing him of being brutal. So the word shakel usually means it, you know, takes away children, so to speak. It's a killing.
Isn't that
a land
word
kills.
That's used sometimes for miscarriage? Is that a word? I don't know why.
It says the land miscarriage.
Miscarriage.
Ah,
so
yeah,
it is the word.
So
yeah, that's the impression. It shows up in Shir Hashirim. It says Shinayach Keider Haktuvot. You keep a very like a flock of white ewes. Shalum and Arachsa that just came up from the bath. Shekulam Matimot, they're all even. Vishakula in Bahem, they have no Shakula in them. And the way that's usually described is there's no missing spaces. There's no teeth that have fallen out, essentially. So that's the idea of Shakula, something which is missing a native part of itself. So I guess miscarriage would be appropriate as well. Where was I? Lost my place? So go get me a tzlochit. Tzlochit is described as, it's the Aramaic description for tzinzenet, which shows up, say, shmot. Unfortunately, that word only shows up once, so nobody's exactly sure what it is, but they put a malo omer in it. That is, they put a wheat portion in it. So some kind of vessel or basket. Hard to say exactly what it is, but something like that. The impression is for the word tzlochit, a tzlochit is a river that runs, a thin, like a rivulet. So I think the impression is it's some kind of a closed basket that can contain water. V'yasimu sham melech, and put salt in it, v'yichurilav. So they bring it to him. V'yetzei amotza amayim, so then he goes out to the source of the water. V'yashach sham melech, and he throws in the salt. V'yamakom amar Hashem refiti l'mayim ha'ila. God says, I have healed this water. V'lo yiyem misham od maved mishakel. You won't have any more death or whatever mishakel is. Or miscarriages, perhaps. And the water was in fact cured until this day. That's probably either Elisha writing at the end of his life, or possibly even Yirmiyahu writing until this day. Kidvar Elisha Asher Diber, just like Elisha said. Okay, I'm going to continue three more psukim, and then we're going to figure out what's going on. Vayal Misham Beit El, so he goes from there to Beit El. Hu Oleh Baderech Unarim Ktanim Yatzu Min Ha'ir, and then there are Narim Ktanim. I'll translate them as little boys. Vayit kalsuvo, and they cursed him. Vayomru lo, alei kareach, go up, you baldy, go up, baldy. So what's confusing here is not really the baldy part. What does alei mean? What does alei mean? It's not. What is that? Where did they tell him to go? Vayifen acharav, vayir aim. So he turns sort of backwards. He turns around. He sees them. Vayikalem b'shem Adonai, and he curses them in the name of God. Vateitzen ashtayim dubim in ayar, two bears come out from the woods. These are probably female bears. It says shtayim, she bears, right? Because the word shtayim, right? The word im at the end doesn't really tell you anything. It's the shtayim which is important. She bears. Vativakana mehem, and they broke him into little pieces. They ripped into them. Arba'im ushnei yiladim, 42. Kids, children. Vayelech misham el har Carmel. He goes from the har Carmel, umisham shav Shomron, and then he goes back to the capital city Shomron. Very, very, at face value, very enigmatic story. Elisha did not come out being very strange. You know, one gets the sense that Elisha's crazy. You know, and that everything is irregular. But now I'd like to take you step by step and show you exactly what is going on here, and then remind you of the conversations that we had in the first place. The first thing you need to know is there's a difference between the prophets. The truth is, the first thing is something that I actually spent some time on, which is that Yericho and Bethel are ir nidachas, in a sense. That is, Bethel is the place where the ego is, and the city is built towards that worship, so much so that when the prophet came there, he wasn't allowed to eat there. The general consensus is it was sort of a pseudo ir nidachas that one could not spend too much time on other than to deliver a message. Chiel, a guy who is Chiel Beit HaEli, which means if you call Chiel Beit HaEli, that means that you're a significant guy in Beit El, goes and he builds Jericho, and the whole thing turns out to be a curse, and he buries his kids there. The reason why the head of Beit El would build Jericho, what I said was that he was making another place where the cult that existed in Beit El could expand. Now, what's interesting here is there are prophets here, and yet how is it possible that there are prophets here if all the prophets are dead? Yezebel is alive and well. Yezebel's husband, Achab, is dead, but Yezebel is alive and well and will be for a few more chapters. So who are these prophets? So as I said before, these prophets, in my opinion, are the prophets of the Beit El, who are a little bit like your Reform Jews of today. I know that's an oversimplification, but I'll stick with it just for now. Which is that they believe in worshiping God. Ego is not avodah zarah, as everybody agrees, except for Rashi. It simply means of communicating with God, but it's the wrong way of communicating to God, so therefore it's an avodat elilim. Sorry, avodah zarah. Unfortunately, there's nobody left. There ain't nobody left. Now, let's just take a look at what happened to Yericho and Beit El. At Yericho, they get down and they bow down to Elisha. At Beit El, somebody comes out and starts cursing, calling him names. Alei Kerech, Alei Kerech. So the first thing to recognize is that there's a big difference between Beit El geographically and Yericho, which even specifies. Going back, if you take a look at verse 15, there's a word which is very significant there. Vayir'uhu v'nei ha'nevi'im asher b'Yericho mineged. The Jordan River is visible from Yericho. It is not visible from Beit El. So when the prophets of Yericho saw what he had done, it was a no-brainer. There was no insult, there was no nothing. They bowed down to him, vayishtachavu lo. When you mishtachav at somebody, that means that person is your master. That's the definition of vayishtachavu. In Beit El, they didn't buy it because they hadn't seen... Don't forget, it wasn't just... If I had to ask you a question, who is questioning Elisha's ability to fill Eliyahu's shoes? How many people have we seen so far who question the ability of Elisha to fill Eliyahu's shoes? The very first person who doubted Elisha's possibility of filling his shoes was who?
Eliyahu
himself. You want to go kiss your mom and dad? So go kiss your mom and dad. What kind of relationship is this? And not only that, Elisha doesn't even take over. Eliyahu keeps his job. He's not ready. Even though Hashem has told him to give up the cloak to Elisha, he's not ready to do such a thing. He throws the cloak at him. Remember that? But all of a sudden, he has his cloak back. It's not clear that the transition went very smoothly at all. Now take a look at the conversation in that light, and you'll see what it is, why they wanted to search for Eliyahu. Why would these guys bow down to Elisha and yet say, listen, we're going to take 50 people. Let's just look for Eliyahu. Just all we want to do is look for Eliyahu because maybe we'll be able to find him. And Elisha then says something strange. No, why not? What difference does it make whether they go look for Eliyahu? It's sweat off his brow whether 50 guys want to wander around the desert for 50, for 3 days or 3 nights. That is, what is the motive? First of all, what is the motive for, there's something going on behind the scenes. Because what is the motive for them to want to go find Eliyahu? Eliyahu's gone. What's your business where Eliyahu went? And why does Elisha not want them to go? So, and then why does he respond when they come back? I told you not to go. Because what they're essentially saying to him is if we can, we're going to bow down to you. You're obviously the guy, but if Eliyahu comes back, you're out the door. We can go back to Eliyahu. You're a nice guy, Elisha. It's like, I like that miracle. That's a pretty solid miracle. But I think you'd be the first to admit, Elisha, that if Eliyahu were back, you would back, that if Eliyahu came back, you would back off. You follow? And therefore, Elisha is simply saying, you're making a mistake. I'm the man. And they say, no, essentially, okay, but. I'll listen to you, but. We'll go see if we can find ourselves a better boss.
I thought they weren't so pleased with Eliyahu.
What's that?
I thought most people weren't pleased with Eliyahu.
Now I'd like to go back, and now that's a segue into what I want to go and to go back and show you something that we skipped over quickly that looked like a nonsensical conversation, and I'll show you that it's a critical conversation. So if you go back to chapter 2, verse... verse 1, verse 2. Chapter 2, verse 1 really just says this is when Eliyahu had to leave. He had to go up to the heavens in a chariot. And in verse 2 it says, "Vayom Eliyahu Elisha, shave na po ki Adonai shlachani a Beit El. God has sent me on a mission to Beit El. Vayom Elisha chai Hashem v'chein avshachai mezvecha. I'm going with you. Vayerdu Beit El." And they went down to Beit El. Now, one of those things where we've seen many times, do not assume that there's no action between two psukim. We could show 100 cases where between two psukim is a humongous amount of action that may not be discussed with you. You have to sometimes infer it. How do we infer it here? Because we look at Pasuk Gimel, it says, "Vayitzu b'nei hanevi'im asher beit el, el Elisha." Now why is that strange that they're going out just to Elisha? Why would that be strange if nothing happened in between verse 2 and verse 3? Because Elisha's with Eliyahu. So just textually it's wrong. It should say that even if they wanted to talk to Elisha, it would still say, "Vayetsu le'Elisha v'Eliyahu." You follow what I'm saying? They go out to Elisha, "Vayomu hayadata ki hayom Hashem lokeach et adonecha me'aroshecha." Don't you know that God is taking your boss away? Now how would those in the Nevi'im know that, assuming that they didn't get prophecy, that God was taking Eliyahu away? How would God know that? How would they know that Eliyahu was going? Let's forget about what they're trying to tell Elisha. How would they simply know that Eliyahu was going to disappear, assuming that it wasn't prophecy?
Because Elisha was there?
Maybe. I think there's a better way. Eliyahu told them. Eliyahu's not with Elisha, apparently, right here, because he's not in the character. God said, "I want you to go on a mission to Beit El." We never find out what the mission is, ever.
So maybe that's the mission, to tell them.
What else could it be? Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? He says, "Go to Beit El and do something for me." We don't know what it is. All we know is the people come out of Beit El and they say, "Oh, I got a news for you, Elisha. Your boss is cutting out." And he goes, "Yatati, I know that. What do you think, I'm out of the loop?" Well, what are they trying to say? What are they really trying to say then? They're trying to say, And by the way, the same conversation goes with Yericho. That is, Eliyahu is sent on a miracle, on a mission, to go to Yericho and say the same thing, and the people of Yericho just happen to respond the same way. There must be something to the response. It can't be an offhand statement, because both of them are saying it. What it's really saying is, your boss is going away. They don't bow down to him. They don't recognize him, which means I think that there are actually... That is, why would they want to be so caustic to him, and why does he respond with that, "I know everything that you know"? Because I think there are two things that Eliyahu was supposed to be telling the people of Yericho and Beit El, something that God told them a long time ago. Not only am I leaving, but Elisha's taking over. Doesn't that? And that makes sense now why they're going out and being so rude to Elisha. By the way, do you know your master is leaving you? It's a very negative thing to say. Where's Eliyahu for all this? Eliyahu's not in the loop. It's one of those side conversations, like one of those little politic things where the guy in you're working in a company and somebody comes over to you and tells you what the boss said about you, as if you were something that happened, as if you're not in the loop. The way that they're treating him is not like a master. What else could Eliyahu have been telling them except for the fact that I'm going? That we know because they know they're going. And two is, if he's going, somebody else has to be boss, and we know who's going to be boss next, because we know who God told him to make boss next, which is Elisha. And yet their response to it is now, good luck at the
negative?
New job.
Yeah, why is it so negative?
It shouldn't be negative. It should be positive.
Yeah.
Even if, or at least, all right, we heard that you're going to be the new boss. They don't say that at all. They refer to him not as a boss, but afuch, the opposite. They refer to him as a servant. And that may be, by the way, I'm not sure, that maybe why Eliyahu doesn't want him to go, because he's afraid of the kind of response that Elisha's going to get, or maybe because Eliyahu really doesn't think Elisha should be with him. It's really hard to say. But there's more of the sense of, why don't you stay home? Let the real men do the work, so to speak. Elisha's simply a nice guy, and nobody takes nice guys very seriously. So now, with my hypotheses, and I can't prove it from the text, but it certainly seems to be so, that there's a missing mission. The mission took place between Pasuk Bet and Pasuk Gimel, and Eliyahu told them the word, and they accepted the fact of it, but not the implications of it. Now let's go back to... So why would these prophets, now getting back to the question, why would these prophets recognize him? Well, they don't like Izebel. Achav, keep in mind, at least worshipped at both doors. He worshipped at both Pesachim. He liked the Baal. He liked God. Now who's left? You got his son, Achaziahu. The first guy he goes to send to when he gets sick is the Baal. You follow? That's different than Achav. Achav at least recognized God. As far as we know, Achaziahu doesn't recognize God, which now explains that conversation. That's why Eliyahu was told to interrupt him and have this really weird statement, which is, there aren't enough, there's no God in Israel that you need to go to the strangers? That message was never delivered to Achav, because that wasn't Achav's problem. Achav believed in God. He probably believed in God as a powerful God. He just believed that God was also a powerful God. Maybe less powerful, maybe more powerful, maybe more powerful on good days, less powerful on bad days. But it wasn't that he didn't recognize God. He had a guy named Avadiah working for him to balance, in fact, what he no doubt recognized. He understood his constituents. I got people like the Baal, I got people like God, I like people like both. Achaziah was told, there's no God around? At least you should have sent to both. Send me a messenger. Send Baal Ekron a messenger. At least that I could fathom. But I don't even get a messenger, and that's why Eliyahu was told to intercept him. Do you see the problem now? Now there's a real problem. So here, if you're political, now you've... If you're an Egel prophet, if you're a prophet of God who worships at the Egel, you're probably feeling pretty comfortable with Achav around, because Achav worships at the Egel. He does his duty at the Egel. Okay, so 400 of your... or X hundreds, or maybe even 1,000 of your godlike prophets who you respect in a distant way. You know, we get together to have a conversation every now and then in their shul, you know, one of those cultural type of things, you know, where all the rabbis get together, including the women rabbis and the men rabbis and the various other things. We all get together every once in a while and we have a little schmooze, we can talk about shalom and find some common ground. I feel a little bad that they were all killed out. Thank God a few hundred of them, 100 of them were saved. But it's not sweat off my back. You know, ultimately, the sword's not coming about to me. But Achav's dead. And Achaziah is only talking to the Baal. And Yehoram will find is no winner, to say the least. Now you got to start getting nervous. Do you follow what I'm saying? It may be very uncool to be a worshiper of the God in any shape. There's no indication that Achaziah would go to Beit El to worship, or go to Yericho to worship, nor would Yehoram, nor anybody else coming out of the Achav line. And Izebel is still sharpening her knives and her fingernails. So now you're starting to think. So Eliyahu goes over, and I don't, all this is purely speculation, but it fits, I think, more or less into the text. He came in and probably said, we need to talk. We need to talk. Everybody recognized the greatness of Eliyahu. It wasn't a question of whether they thought he was a great rabbi / prophet. That was not the question. They knew he was a powerhouse. They just didn't like his personal style. But now that they got nothing left, so all of a sudden it may be time for reconciliation. What's in it for Elisha and Eliyahu? They're the only prophets that are left. They are the only prophets that are left. 100 people still in the cave, can't come out of the cave, they're dead. These ones apparently are still reasonably tolerable. So the mission is for Eliyahu to say, your next boss is Elisha. When he comes to Yericho and they recognize his power, they bow down to him. And yet, they're not crazy about it. Let's talk, let's see if I can still find Eliyahu. By the way, the word B'nai Chayil, I don't want to take the time to prove it now, but if you take a look at the beginning of Malachim, an Eshet Chayil and B'nai Chayil doesn't really mean a warrior woman, it means loyal. B'nai Chayil means somebody who is loyal to a cause. The reason why I know this, the famous case is when Shlomo was having a little fight over who was going to be the king with his brother Adoniyahu. So Adoniyahu's side said, let's send what's-his-name's son, Kihu B'nai Chayil B'Yagidu Lanu Et Adavar. He is trustworthy, he is loyal, and he'll tell us the truth, that it's safe to send him. That's probably the best definition of B'nai Chayil. Radak doesn't like, of course, that they're soldiers, so he comes up with B'nai Koach. But I think that fact to translate loyal is a better translation. So what they're saying to him is, listen, we'll send a loyal guy. We'll be loyal to you and loyal to Eliyahu. And we're bowing down to you, but we'd really like to go back to the old man, so to speak. As soon as they find out that the old man ain't coming back, that Eliyahu's not coming back, now we can resume Pasuk Yutet. Now Yutet makes a lot more sense. Now they want a miracle. I want a miracle. And that's why he pulls off what Chazal call a miracle inside a miracle. He sweetened the water by pouring salt in it, which is sort of like what they say, nes betoch nes. It's not the only one. It's where a single miracle is not good, but I'm going to go miracle on top of miracle, which is similar to Eliyahu's filling up the water. It's not enough the fire comes down from the sky, but I got to fill up the whole trench with water and wet down the korban to make sure that God is really doing the show. So that's a very powerful statement. And what do they do? He succeeds. What happens in Chaf Gimel? In Chaf Gimel, this is something I've sort of hinted at before, so it won't be much of a surprise. In Chaf Kimmel it says, "Vayal misham Beit El v'hu olev v'darech, u'na'arim k'tanim yatsu min ha'ir v'ikasu b'arimu alei kerech, alei kerech." Let's leave alone for a second. What does it mean, na'arim k'tanim? When they're calling him a kareach, that's not an insult. What it means is, I know Eliyahu, and you're not Eliyahu. How do we know this? Because remember, Ahaziyahu had his messengers intercepted. And Eliyahu sends it back and says, you're going to die. And Ahaziyahu says, what does he look like? And what do they say? He's a hairy guy. Hairy, hairy guy. So when they say, you, Elisha, are a baldy, that's significant. They're not, you'll never find, if you found the word baldy in Tanakh over and over again as an insult, fine. And there are a few insults in Tanakh. B'nei Beliyal, there are some insults. Kereach is simply not one of them. It never shows up here and there. When I have a word in just the previous chapter that says that Eliyahu is a Baal Seyar, and then I have this whole conflict with your no Eliyahu, which is what's been going on up to this point, and Beit El comes out and says, you're a Kereach, that means you're not a Baal Seyar. So what they're doing essentially is rejecting him. Now we also know they were rejecting him. Why? Because they don't come down to bow to him. Just comparing their actions against the people of Yericho make it quite clear. And whatever mission, even if you don't want to play my mission game, even though I really think it's right, whatever Eliyahu said and did in Yericho was the same thing he did in Beit El. And the same response that Beit El gave was the same response as Yericho gave. And therefore, if Yericho then treats Elisha in a certain way, one would only expect that Beit El would treat him in the same way. And yet there's no response from them whatsoever. Beit El disappears. They don't come out. Nothing happens. We go to Perek Gimel and the whole story is over. We never know what happens in Beit El. We never know what happens in Beit El. The only thing we know is that these Na'arim Tanim come and simply say to him, you're no Eliyahu. He curses them b'shem Hashem. And they get killed by the bear. So the first thing, now what I'd like to point out, which is the thing that caused everybody such difficulty, is the word Na'arim K'tanim. So let's just get rid of those words right away. The assumption is that Na'arim K'tanim are little boys, and surely that's the more probable translation. However, a Na'ar has a specific use when it comes to prophets, which we know from Moshe. When Moshe was in the Ohel, it said, V'Yoshua Mishato Na'ar. Now he doesn't say that, it says, by Yosef, V'hu Na'ar et Echav. Nar doesn't just mean young boy. It actually comes from a Phoenician word called Merianus, which means the chosen one. Now, very often they were young boys, just like soldiers today are young boys. They are. You choose them in life, so to speak. You choose them early in life, and you train them. If anything, you would say apprentice servant. That's why it came to be understood as Nar, because very often the Narim started off exactly as Narim. However, we have many, many cases where Na'arim are not young children. Now, what about K'tanim? So I can't do much with K'tanim, but I can tell you that if we go back, and this is my small apologetics, but very small, I think, if we go back to the fight that Yeravam and Rechavam first had in Beit El, so if you remember, he went to ask his father. Rechavam was given a request. We want you to chill out, lighten up, and we'll serve you. Rechavam probably knew he didn't want to listen anyway, but he figured he'd check two sets of advisors. One advisors were called the Zakenim, and they worked for Shlomo, and they told him you should really serve these people, and then they'll serve you. And then he went over to his own servants, who were called the Yiladim. The Yiladim. Yiladim were clearly not children, because it says he grew up with them, and he was 40 years old when he took the throne. So there you have the word Yeladim being used as not old, but immature. I can't tell you for sure what Na'arim K'tanim does not mean children. I cannot tell you that. However, that is not my sense, given everything that's going around.
Better young person.
Yeah, what do you got there?
Little boys.
Little boys, okay.
I don't know where he gets his name from, but little boys, irrelevant and lacking mitzvah observance. Alternatively, they might have been killed to prevent him from sinning in the future.
Yeah, that's midrashic. I'll go through the midrashim in a second.
It bothers people, but
it bothers Chazal.
Like you, who basically want to make a case that they were not little kids,
right?
Old enough to know better, and there are those who think, you know, they're little. little kids, and it's in their interest that they're killed now, so they're going to sin later on.
I'll mention those, and I'll give all the possibilities. I'm going to walk through every single possibility. I just wanted to start off with mine so I can bias you.
And it also says here, as a consequence of what Elisha did, he gets punished.
That's right. But you know what? I'll tell you the problem with that. What book is that? Oh, okay. You know who that is? What's that? No. Kaplan Elman, who teaches Bible and he's a Talmudic scholar. Teaches YU. It's a very good book. What I disagree with on Elman on this one is that he's glomming them all together. These are differences of opinions in the Gemara. The Gemara says either he was punished, or another rabbi says that they deserved it, and then then there's an argument about why little kids may have deserved it. So unfortunately, he sort of glommed everything together, which is they deserved it, but he also got punished, which is not how the Gemara really lays it out. But I'll go through step by step and show you what all the possibilities are. But I did really want to bias you and want to say that when you see the word nar, when it comes to prophecy, or another one, when the spirit of Moshe goes to the 70 people in the Midbar, and Eldad and Medad are giving their prophecy in the Machaneh. So it says, Vayaratz Hanar El Moshe. This is not a little tiny boy. This is a... what's that? No, it wasn't Yoshua. It was translated as son. What was Moshe's son's name? Manasseh, right?
Gershom.
Gershom. It was listed as Gershom. It's hard to say it was. It can't be Yoshua only because when the Nard gives his report, then Yoshua says, let's put him in jail. So you know it's not Yoshua, although it should be. But it's some other guy serving Moshe. It's not a little child running from the Machaneh who knows Eldad. He would not a 10-year-old boy would know Eldad and Medad, whether they're prophesizing in the camp. There's somebody who's concerned about the status of Moshe, because you're not supposed to go to the camp. You're not supposed to bring the mountain to Muhammad. Lahafil. You're supposed to bring Muhammad to the mountain. The people aren't supposed to be prophesizing in the camp. The camp is supposed to be coming to Moshe, and now his 70 elders. But now everything's getting away from it. You've decentralized leadership, and now all of a sudden the congressmen feel like they can go out and rally the people, bring the word of God directly to the people. That Nar is not a child. It can't be a child. He could certainly be young, but I wouldn't put him less old than Yosef at 18 years old. Whenever you're dealing with prophetic issues and prophecies and prophets, you see the word Nar, I think it is a poor translation to translate it as child. And therefore, I stand by Narim Ktanim with Chazal's opinion to a certain extent, which is not that they were Narim, but they were Narim in knowledge, and Ktanim, that they were Kitnei Emunah. They had very little faith. Now, I think that there's something to that, because if we could establish Narim doesn't mean a child, then Ktanim doesn't mean, if it means servant, then the word Katan is no longer talking about an age. If Nar is an age category, you see what I'm saying? If Nar means young person, then Katan can only modify that to make them really, really young. But if Nar means a servant, then on servant Katan, I could say it in English. If I say a little boy, that means little in age. If I say he was a little man, that doesn't mean he was tiny. That means there wasn't much to him. If I say he was a small king, a small president, that doesn't mean that he was little. That's defining the word katan, and certainly in modern Hebrew, katonti mikol atov asher asita. You have reduced all of the wonderful things that I did for you. The word katan is as multivalent as it is in English. It depends on what it's defining. Then you figure out whether it's talking about qualitative kitznut or quantitative kitznut, young in years or actually young in quality. And that's why I think that it stands. That translation stands here.
Let me ask you a question. How would you then feel if at the end of the day, they were a little boy.
Oh.
In 8 and
12. I wouldn't be comfortable with that, but I would tell you the following. So I'd like to support Chazal's statement. Chazal do say that maybe they were little boys. The idea you should know, I don't want to get into now because I'll get into trouble, but there is an idea in Judaism that sometimes it's the famous question. It was a great movie by that guy who likes Scientology. I can't remember his name. What's the actor who's into Kate and what's his name? Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise was in a great movie called The Minority Report, which is all about putting people in jail before they did it, because you knew for sure they were going to do it. If you haven't seen Minority Report, it's a movie well worth seeing. There is such an idea in Judaism. Judaism, Gemara Sota has what? Sora Morer is somebody that you kill because of what they have not done yet. Ben Sora Morer has not broken any laws. They've eaten a lot of meat, a lot of things, and they've stolen. Well, we want a little more. We want a little more proof in Judaism. In the case of Ben Shorah Morer, you have to prove that the mother told him what to do and he didn't listen. The father told him what to do and he didn't listen. He ate this humongous amount of food and he stole money from them in order to feed his habit. And there are just so many stories about people who feed their habits, whose mother and fathers, this. Unfortunately, in poor societies or drug-ridden societies, the mother and father very often pay the price for their addict children. So this is not an unheard of thing. There are, I don't remember the Gemara in Sota, the Mishnah in Sota lists, I believe, three or four things. One of them actually is, interestingly enough, homosexual rape. If a guy is going to commit homosexual rape, he may be killed. That doesn't mean a homosexual. A person who's going to commit homosexuality may not be killed. He will be punished afterwards on whatever level he's going to be punished. But homosexual rape, you can kill the person before he ever gets there, which is very, very interesting. By the way, not bestiality, not anything, just specifically homosexual rape, you can kill before the act happens. And of course, the third case is the famous one, which is a din rodef. If I'm chasing somebody with a knife, there's no proof that I won't drop a knife, slip, or that I'm not just joking. I have no proof. Maybe I just wanted to get that close and stop. Maybe I wouldn't have succeeded. You kill the person, now you might think you kill the person so he can't kill you, as a way of saving your life, but that's not the way Judaism looks at it. You kill him because you must consider him as having already done it. You see what I'm saying? Because it's a lock, and you want to prevent him from being a murderer, you kill him for his sake. For his sake. He is now guilty of punishment. You kill him before he could get to the point that he could actually commit the murder. Same with homosexual rape. The same thing with the Ben Sorer Umorer. It's not, most people think Din Rodef because I had no choice. I had to protect myself. It's like the Chai Bahem. It's not like, right, you could break the laws in order to make sure that your own life is spared. I could break Shabbat to make sure that I live. That would not be the case because then I wouldn't need a special case by Din Rodef because I would simply have a Chai Bahem, which is perfectly acceptable. The din of rodef is specifically because you must kill the person before he commits the act for, because it is specifically a punishment. You're punishing a person for what he has not yet done. That's how the Gemara defines it. What? The Gemara doesn't, that's the assumption. The Mishnah doesn't specify. What's that? Say again?
You're going to wipe out Gaza.
What?
You're going to wipe out Gaza.
Now you're going to pull me into politics, are you? I'm going to have to undo this recording.
Right on.
Yeah,
right on.
It is. We don't know that. We don't know that for sure. No, I'm talking about. I'm avoiding your politics. I'm ignoring the politics.
Times are marching.
What's that?
Times are marching.
All right. So I better. The Mishnah only mentions these cases without being. No, you're right. That is that the Gemara certainly speculates on that for Ben Sorama. So there is this idea of killing somebody before they get done, and therefore, what do Chazal say here? Chazal say based on these Narim Ktanim that because of what they would grow up to be based on their actions, so he was able to kill them. But still, all they did was be insulting. So Chazal give another thing which is much harder to swallow, which is, I'll say it because Chazal said it, and we have to try to, Chazal, we're not dumb, we just have to try to understand their philosophies, which is that he saw in prophecy, and the reason why Chazal say that is because it does say here that he's going to curse them in the name of God. It's hard to curse them in the name of God when God isn't supporting his actions. So it says he saw that they were all born on Yom Kippur. Each one of them was conceived on Yom Kippur. And then, but then you get into a big philosophical issue, which could be a person be punished for the act of their parents, which the Torah says no. So that's a different difficult philosophy as well. The other possibility is that he didn't curse them to die whatsoever. And the Pasuk actually never says it. So it says he cursed them. Right? Take a look carefully at the Pasuk. Yeah. It simply says, he simply cursed them. And then the she-bears came out and killed them. What is the idea? That once he cursed them, put the curse upon them, it's like their real nature came out, so to speak, and God decided it was sort of like removing any protection that God would normally have on them, so to speak, which is they deserve death. But not everybody deserves the death, gets it because this life is complicated. But when Eliyahu says, listen, these guys are cursed, Elisha curses them, it's as if it takes away the veil and the miracle happens right away, the bears come right away. There's nothing there. God has essentially withdrawn any kind of natural protection for them and they immediately die, which means they were actually dying for sins that they created. It was just that the whatever protection they may have had was removed by the curse, but it wasn't Elisha designed to pull out the bears. Now, first you have to know is this means that, and against element in this case, Chazal argue about these things. And you don't have to pick and choose. When Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel argue, all Chazal argue all the time. They argue not only about normative halacha, they argue about their philosophies. They have different philosophical opinions. The nice thing about it is when normative halacha, you have to pick who's right and who's wrong, because you can't do two things. But when it comes to philosophies, we can be paradoxical slightly, and we can say, oh, I see this side, I see that side, I kind of get all those sides. In my opinion, I prefer the side that they were kitznut emunah. I believe that approach of Chazal, which is only one approach of Chazal, and others argue, is that they simply were lacking faith and not that they were smart children. I don't see small children running out and getting behind Elisha and calling him Kireach, which is such a sly thing to do. But the only one thing I guess I want to end off with is the Gemara in Megillah ends off with a very interesting story. A girl walks into the temple. She takes off her shoe. I don't know if you know the story. She throws it at the Mizbeach and she goes, Shu'ala, Shu'alata, you're a fox, you're a fox. I think the idea is that she's cursing God and cursing all the accoutrements that God, you know, they set worship of God. And what they did was they took away, this is at the end of the period of the Second Temple, her father was a Kohen, and her father's whole family was then puzzled to work in the Beit HaMikdash. The Gemara says, how is it possible? The father didn't do anything, it was just the daughter. So the Gemara says that somebody doesn't act this way unless they learn it somewhere. It's not so much that you're punishing somebody for the sake of their parents, but I have to say, in my years of teaching, I have very rarely run across. I know it happens. It certainly happens that kids sometimes wind up far from the tree of the apple. You know, the apple sometimes does drop far from the tree. Mm-hmm. I have yet to really see a case. I have yet to be surprised at parent-teachers conference when I meet the parent. I remember once I had a kid who couldn't pay attention to me, not for a single word. So his parents come in and they're very stressed out. He's like, the boy's like this all the time. Kids can't sit still. And he doesn't, you know, no concentration. So the parents come in and they're sitting in the parent-teachers conference and the mother is very, very upset. She wants to know what she can do and what's my advice. And the father's going like this all the time. You didn't hear a word I said. So I think there may be something to that. If they were children, they were a reflection of how their parents weren't just people. They were prophets. And if this is the way they treated Elisha, then maybe that's the way their parents were as well. And therefore, when he curses them, all of the evil that was in Beit El came out. That's a possible understanding. I happen to prefer, really non-apologetically, I do not believe Nara and Tani means little children. I think it means servants, i.e. apprentices, prophetic apprentices, who have very little going for them, very little, katan, going for them. I believe that's the correct translation. I really do, based on what I know about Beit El, based on what I know about the use of the word Nar when discussing prophecy, based on the word Yeladim that shows up earlier in Malachim. I do not believe they were little children. They were apprentices. They rejected Elisha, and now Elisha has an interesting issue, which is, can I afford to be rejected here?
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one question? Is there any meaning to the bear, the 42? Is there any allegorical meaning to that?
I don't know. I have not seen a connection. If you find one, is there any commentary? Anybody have any commentary about the bears? But that's also a part. That's also.
And then Sota explains the use of the noun here as denoting that they were bare menorahim of divine commandments, irreligious.
They were what? What does that mean?
They were. Translation for little children.
Oh.
Better young persons, and the insult to the prophet was more likely to be resented and punished when it came from youth than from little children.
Yeah, well, that's also
a part. Rabbi Sota 46b explained the use of the noun here as denoting that they were bare, B-A-R-E, menorahim, of divine commandments.
Yeah, Nari means to be bare. Now, the English translation is making a pun on the word B-E-A-R and B-A-R-E, but that's unacceptable in English. I think that's a little sneaky on the Santino there.
They're completely different in vitro.
I'll look up the bears. I don't know if there's. I don't know if anybody mentions. I did not. I don't remember coming across whether there was a symbolic reference. There are some funny things with numbers. The word, the number 42 is very strange. Remember when I showed you the word 7,000? We immediately saw that the 7,000 people fighting for Akkad were, you know, connected to that number 7,000 who were loyal to God. The word, the number 42. All it reminds me of is the answer to the ultimate question, right? That's the, from, you don't know that from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The answer is 42, but you don't know what the question is. And nobody's Hitchhiker fans here. This computer figures out the answer to the universe, and it comes out with the number 42. But they don't know what the question is, so they have to come up with a bigger computer to figure out what the question is. But it's a famous. The number 42 in science fiction circles is very famous. But here, there's no. I don't see a relationship. I mean, what's 42? I don't recognize the other number 42. Now, Chazal do play with 42. They say 42 in Gematria matches up with something significant. I can't remember what. But they come up with something. Oh, right. The 42, it was 6 times 7, which was the number of Balak sacrifices that he makes trying to destroy the Jewish people. So what you can see is Chazal are also reaching, because you get this number 42. Now, normally in Tanakh, if you don't have a real purpose to have a specific number, just give a generic number. I care whether it's 42 or 40. Not only that, the way the numbers are expressed is strange. Shtayim Dubim is very strange. But not only that, it could be Shtayim. It's not unacceptable grammatically, but it's rare. But also look at the other one. Look at the number at the end with the look Arba'im Ushtei. It shouldn't be Arba'im Ushnei. It should be Arba'im Ushnayim Anashim. Again, not that that Arba'im and Shnei is impossible, but it's less common. So in both cases, I use a less common number. There's something funny about these numbers. I have not found a solution to it, which I can point at. So I think it's a great question. But ultimately, I think really the issue here, and just to close up with this, is Elisha's not playing games here, and neither are these kids, whoever they are.
No.
Yericho barely accepted, no pun, they barely accepted Elisha, and Elisha had to force them, essentially, with miracles. Beta, who saw no miracles, refused to accept him, and Elisha made a decision. Can I afford to have these prophets, the only ones left, not accept me? And the answer is no. Because if he can't get these guys to follow him, he's got nothing. He can't do his job. So whether if he had to get some heads rolling in order that Beit El would come along onto his side, that's what he was going to do. Whether that's a decision which is acceptable, I don't know, but I think that's what Elisha has in mind. If you don't got a team to play behind you, you got no team. And sometimes you have to sacrifice. I hate to use stupid cliches, but sometimes you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And he's breaking 42 eggs in order to make an omelet. After this, by the way, there is no question about whether Elisha is the man. Nobody will ever, ever again call him baldy, not bow down to him, ask him whether we could really find Eliyahu. It won't happen. From this point on, Eliyahu is the man until he dies some 5, 6, 7 chapters later. Elisha. Thank you. Elisha is the man.
When he cursed them, it doesn't say that he cursed them that this was going to happen to them.
That's correct.
You know,
yeah, that's why Chazal,
what was
that, as if God himself decided what would be their punishment.
Yes.
Yeah, but all that is more or less just trying to apologize how we could kill little kids. I would avoid it simply by just saying he had to kill. I'm not sure there were little kids at all, but I am sure that he had to kill. He had to kill because otherwise he would not have. If he had a place where prophets were able to thumb their nose at the lead prophets, you got nothing left. Think about it as, what is the punishment for insubordination in the face of an enemy? What does an officer responsible do when his soldier is being insubordinate in the face of the enemy? And the answer is, he needs to kill them on the spot. And absolutely happens, there are cases of it. Not only that, those officers are not to be punished, they're actually to be commended. And they get commended. There are cases like that. I'm not a war historian, but I think if you look at war history of World War I, World War II, you'll find such cases where the troops rebelled against the officers and they were court-martialed.
They call it the Riot Act.
What's that?
The Riot Act, and you kill them.
What's that? Say again?
First of all, you read the Riot Act and you kill them.
Oh, that's
the idea behind the Riot Act.
Uh-huh, I see.
The
riding
of the troops.
Right. I see. Very interesting. Good to know. So that's what's going on here. This is the Riot Act.
You skipped over to, you were going to come back to the use of the phrase Vayashav Shem.
Oh, Vayashav, right. So Vayashav Hashem Melech Le'olam. Vayeshev does not mean to sit. It means to sit. More often it means to settle, but most often it means to control or to rule. What's that? Say again. Oh, no, that's from the word shuv. In this case, it comes from the word shave, which is different. It comes. It's a different root. Shin yud vet as opposed to shin vav vet. It's difficult to tell these differences, to be honest. But it's very subtle. Wait, shuv. Oh no, sorry. Shuv to return. Shin vav vet. Shav vayashav is to sit, which is yud shin vet yashavti. But the yud falls off when you conjugate it. How do you tell that it's yashav as opposed to shuv? So I can show you afterwards. It's a boring piece of grammar. It has to do with how the vowels take a look, so you can tell the difference. In any event, vayeshev Hashem melech l'olam means that God didn't sit ruler of the world. He sat on his throne, so to speak. So when it says vayeshev b'yericho, that means that he's the man in Yericho, and then he decides to go over to Beitel, and in Beitel he's got some problems that he needs to take care of. So anyway, I went over as usual. So
the significance of the curing of the waters.
Yeah. Oh, a hot miracle. So to show that they finally accepted him. There will be a little bit more. You know what? We'll return to those waters. They'll become significant a little bit later. Sweet waters will be significant a little later. But I think it's just a recognition that Yericho did come along after they realized there was no other way to go, and contrast that with Beitel. Well, let's just put the miracle at Yericho is quite a bit different than the miracle at Beitel, and that creates a contrast between Yericho and Beitel. Yeah, which also shouldn't surprise you. Keep in mind, Yericho is an upstart city with not a lot of history. The history of Beitel goes back, to Avraham Avinu. So there's probably a certain ego when it comes to they feel they're New Yorkers. You know, they got a certain there's a certain history that goes back, and no doubt they're a much tougher cookie to crack than is